You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is MJ Green, the author of A Conflict of Interest, her firsthand account of living and working in Afghanistan. MJ, thanks for joining us today.
David, it's a pleasure.
MJ, I read the book in its entirety. I want to get into some detail about the book, not great detail, because this was well worth my time, and I'm happy to say, reading the book, because I didn't know what to expect. But I want to encourage the listeners to go out and pick this book up, and they'll find out why once they do that. For the benefit of the listeners, can you give them a little bit of background about who you are? And please, if you can you start here, like on page 251 of the book, where it says that, of course, you're a native Australian. You were born and educated in one of the most isolated cities in the world.
Yes, David, it's true. I was born in a place called Perth, Western Australia, which is one of the most isolated and underpopulated cities in the world. And I came from a very solid upbringing. My father was an ex-Special Forces, ex-Vietnam vet. You know, I pretty much had a very good education, very privileged education compared to a lot of people out there in the world today. And in comparison to, obviously, to a place such as Afghanistan, where education is a luxury, if you like. So, you know, when you compare a lot of countries out there that are facing economic hardship, I consider myself to be very lucky. And I'd spent a lot of time of my life living and working in parts of the UK and Europe. And really, when this opportunity arose, I really felt that I had something good to offer, something whereby I could contribute and help to piece Afghanistan back together again.
Now, it says here on page 16 that you are a fair-skinned, blue-eyed, blonde Australian. You're not going to find too many of those in Afghanistan, right?
That's absolutely true. In fact, Dave, there was one instance when my driver and I were driving along good old Jalalabad Road, which is one of the main roads leading in and out of Kabul. And we happened to be driving alongside a family which was in a typical yellow and white Corolla. And even though you're encouraged to wear long dress, long sleeve clothing, and obviously a scarf to hide my blonde hair, I happened to look outside the window of the car and I could actually see the entire family just staring at me like they'd seen an alien, because it was probably one of the first times they'd actually seen a fair-skinned person and being female. So it's amazing, you know, when not always people are used to seeing different skin colours, particularly being a female. And that was during the early part of my tenure of working and living in Afghanistan.
Okay, so this was in 2007, right, that you went to Afghanistan?
That's right.
And you said here in the book, I guess you were 37?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, so 37-year-old, fair-skinned, blonde, blue-eyed Australian going into a country like Afghanistan. Wow. You knew you wanted to do it. You were hired by this company. And, of course, in the book, the only names that are revealed are names that are already well-known to the public. But everything else is like a nom de guerre. This company that you were hired by on page 19, and of course you call it Teratota, is that how you say it?
Teratota, that's correct, yeah.
Okay. It says here on page 19, like most multinationals, Teratota, and again, listeners, Teratota is not the real name of the company, offers full-service supply chain solutions worldwide. These solutions are usually described as end-to-end and or turnkey, and they range the gamut: fuel, food supply, procurement, transportation, storage, technology, site services, and so on. So basically, is this similar to this trend that has been going on for the past several decades where civilian contractors will pick up what the military had done in the past?
Absolutely, David. That's exactly right. It's really important. You know, when you've got a military operation happening to the size of what was happening in Afghanistan, you really need on the ground support there, particularly with logistics and supply chain. There's a lot of challenges that one experiences in a place such as Afghanistan, where you are constantly challenged by what's going on around you and the surrounding regions.
Because I was in the military myself, in the Navy, and I've noticed over the decades since I've been in that there's been a significant turnover of duties to civilians. So I wasn't quite sure what that was, but thank you for explaining that. One of the significant parts of the book is that one of the activities being done by the company was really not appropriate for the company to be doing. However, it was boosting sales significantly, so I can understand why it was that it remained. And this is something that was referred to as export, right?
That's right.
What is that for the listeners?
Export was a euphemism for selling alcohol on the black market. So export was alcohol that was not legally housed in Afghanistan. And as you can imagine, that has huge ramifications, not only on the war effort, but it's a little bit like putting an additional weapon in the hands of the Taliban, because alcohol is forbidden in a Muslim country. And you can imagine how the Taliban would feel about alcohol being sold to the Afghan people.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the general manager that you were replacing actually was let go because of export, right?
That's correct, yes.
And of course, alcohol here, like you say on page 38, that it's a very volatile commodity and a great resource, and that with the exception of fuel, alcohol was the most sought after product on the black market. Pretty surprising, considering that it's a Muslim country, but was that generally before the non-Muslims? Is alcohol sought after by the people who are working there, like in your company and others?
Absolutely. Look, I think, David, one of the things to understand is that when you're in a conflict zone, when you're living in and working in an environment such as Afghanistan, which is, you know, there's a tremendous amount of pressure, you're seeing things that most people don't see in normal day society. You know, there's a lot of bombings that are carried out, you know, suicide bombings, there's a lot of insurgent attacks. So people turn towards some kind of vice, some kind of escapism. So you can imagine alcohol was highly sought after as in a way to sort of relax, unwind and let loose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I did make a note of that. I will get to that because that was a very poignant paragraph. You say here on page 57 that alcohol was so lucrative that it would often boost sales by 50%. That's huge.
Yeah, look, it did. It was amazing, particularly in my business unit, because I was responsible for all retail operations on the ground in Afghanistan. And we supplied all sorts of other products, but alcohol was the most sought after, absolutely. And sometimes we couldn't keep up with the demand because so many people wanted the alcohol, and it was amazing.
Yeah, and that was on page 111, where you say a conflict zone has many types of casualties, and working in such an environment, whether as a member of the military or as a civilian, often takes its toll on human behavior. That's what I wanted to get into now, was life there. Now, for you, I made a couple of notes here. On page 122, now this is life for you as the general manager, page 122, where you said you had at least 200 emails. Is that like in a day that that happened?
That's pretty accurate. Yeah, usually on a daily basis, I'd receive between 150 to 200, sometimes more emails.
Wow.
And it's just email traffic coming from all directions, and you just get used to it.
Mm-hmm.
You really do. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you said here that on page 136, and this is pretty amazing. I know for certain, 100% certain, I would just collapse. You say here that you were exhausted after several months of traveling back and forth between Kabul and Kandahar, with visits in between to Dubai. I had been averaging 6 flights a week, working 12 and 14-hour days, often 7 days a week, and rarely fewer than 6. Was this during this particular time, or was this the average?
Look, it was. It was amazing because we had a huge project on down in Kandahar, and, you know, there was a lot of flying. There was a lot of flying in and out, and sometimes you'd spend half a day in the airport just waiting for a military flight or waiting for a commercial flight to happen, and then I might be there for a day or half a day, and then I'd fly back again to Kabul. So there's a lot of flying in and out, particularly when you're looking at traveling from a place such as Kabul into a remote location such as Kandahar or Terrencott, you know, one of the FOBs, the forward operating bases, because a lot of these places, you know, in the remote locations of Afghanistan, you can't get to by car. So you've got no choice to either get there on a fixed wing, an aeroplane, or by helicopter. So there was a lot of traveling in and out. And look, it became part of my life, part of my routine, my weekly routine, and to the point where at one stage I was traveling so much, I couldn't sleep in a bed. I could sleep in the chair of a plane, but my bed just did not know when to relax when it came to trying to lie down on a bed. So yeah, that's how hectic my routine was for a number of months.
Wow. Okay. And on page 222, yeah, that's where you said, sleepless nights were my biggest challenge. And this was when you were in Gay Paris. You say, I found it exceedingly difficult to breathe at times, and I would often sleep with several pillows to raise my head. I wore heat plasters all over my back, and this relieved the numerous knots in my muscles, helping me to relax my body and my mind. So this was incredibly stressful. What I was wondering was, is the main reason that someone would, and not you, but your average person would do something like this, it's because of the money? Is it good money?
It wasn't the money that attracted me to the role. My reasons for wanting to go there was because I had come to a point in my life where I wanted something fresh to do. I wanted a real challenge. I'd done pretty much the same similar roles for the past decade. And it came to a point where I needed a real challenge in my life. And, you know, I'd come from a military upbringing and I was immediately attracted to the challenges that were associated with taking on the role as general manager and being in a conflict zone. A lot of people that I worked with were attracted to working in Afghanistan because of the incentives, the financial incentives associated. You know, they couldn't get a job back in their own country that would pay enough money to support their families. A lot of my team came from the Philippines, came from Nepal, came from India, where they couldn't get a job. They had mouths to feed. They had families to support. They had children to educate. In the book, I make mention of the soldiers of fortune. You know, they risked their lives to live and work in a war zone to give their family a better life, a better quality of life. And, you know, a lot of my peers that were working in the same company, they were there for the same reasons. They were there because they had children that needed university education and so on and so forth. And that's what motivates a lot of people to go into areas such as conflict zones, because the financial incentives are there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said on page 183 that it was mostly, and you mentioned Filipinos, Indians, Nepalese, and of course, Zimbabweans. And these are referred to, as I learned from reading your fine book, TCNs. I guess that's what, third country nationals?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. And also on page 210, when you were talking about heading to Mazar-e-Sharif, that, wow, wait till the people, when they get this book, they read that. Incredible. You said it was predominantly Swedish there. So how many different ethnic groups from around the world are represented or were represented in Afghanistan when you were there from 07 to 10?
There was 26 nations. They were all stationed all throughout Afghanistan in different camps. It was wonderful, really, because you got to meet all sorts of different people. And, you know, each of those nations played, you know, their own part in terms of the mission to fight against terrorism and to help rebuild Afghanistan. And there was a tremendous amount of work that went on behind the scenes, a lot of rebuilding certain areas. And there was a lot of work that was put into trying to make a difference in rebuilding Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. But you made it for 3 years, and that's really not the usual amount of time that people last. You say on page 201, as many staff eventually crumbled under the pressures of being in theater for the long term. What do they usually last, about a year? That was their employment contract?
Usually the employment contract is an open-ended contract because of the mission. Nobody knows exactly when the mission's going to end. And, you know, obviously it depends on performance, on work performance. But, you know, there were some challenges, which obviously I mentioned in the book, which concerned the visa issue.
Mm-hmm. Very nerve-wracking, the part of that book. You say here on page 95, many staff were unable to endure the conditions in theater for more than a year. And after they completed the 12 months agreed in their employment contracts, they often never returned. That's what I was alluding to. So you lasting three times the norm says a lot about you, because I use the word nerve-wracking. I would have to say that that was a word that came back to me over and over again, reading what you had gone through and your descriptions of your job. Wow, I got to give you a lot of credit for being able to do this. Incredible what you went through. And of course, talking about it now with you, we're just scratching the surface here about this book, because what I loved about it was that it didn't waste my time. And when I say that, I mean, I don't read fiction books. This was a nonfiction book. However, it read like a fiction book. I don't know if anybody ever mentioned that before to you, but it literally felt like I was reading a thriller novel.
Yeah. Look, one of the reasons why I endured 3 years there, Dave, is because my team on the ground and I, we had developed a close bond. And when you're in a war zone and you are living with these people 24/7, okay, they become your family away from home. I was like their mother figure. And I knew that anything that happened there, they turned towards me for strength and for direction. And I didn't want to just up and leave, because I knew that without me, they would not have had the support that they needed to exist. So, you know, my commitment was to them as much as their commitment was to me. And that's one of the reasons why I decided to be there as long as what I did. And not only that too, there was a lot of projects that we were developing. And it's like anything, when you love what you do and you have a certain amount of responsibility to yourself as well as to your people, you want to see that through no matter what. And that's why I lasted as long as what I did, even after the corruption had been uncovered within my own organisation and action had been taken. There were still other things such as the situation with not being able to obtain visas. There is no way I could have just let my people to fend for themselves. I had to be there and see them through it.
Very important book. Very significant that you put it down into words, because I don't think that there is another book like this out there where somebody who had spent so much time here in this country, Afghanistan, so close to the ground and doing what you had done, I don't think that there's been a book like this written so far. Are you aware of any books like this?
I don't believe there are, no.
Wow. Have you ever written a book before?
No, I haven't. I can honestly say, because of everything I experienced in Afghanistan, the people around me kept saying, MJ, you've got to write a book. You've got to write a book. You know, I started diarizing things at an early stage during my time in Afghanistan. And I really made the decision probably later on in the piece of being in Afghanistan to really seriously think about turning my diary entries into the book. I think what's really important about my book is that it does give you an on-the-ground insight into what is actually going on in Afghanistan. Unfortunately, as is the case in most conflict situations, we only see what we see or hear on the news. We don't actually understand what it's like to live and work on a daily basis in a place such as Afghanistan. And that's what I wanted to demonstrate to people who perhaps have never been in a conflict zone. And one of the things I noticed when I would come home for periods of time for my R&R is that people generally back home are really only focused on what's happening in their own daily lives. And they may only watch 20 minutes of news every day if they're lucky. So people's understanding of what's really happening is very limited. And often we are conditioned or educated for whatever reason in terms of what's going on, and we don't really get to see the true picture. So that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, was because I wanted people to have a better understanding that truth is never on the surface. You really have to dig down deep in order to find it. And my epigraph is, in war, truth is the first casualty. And I think that's something that people really need to understand. You know, we look around us and we see things that are happening in Syria, not just Afghanistan, but Syria, Iraq. And often we are misled by one person's viewpoint and not by the actual truth itself. And I think that's really important. We have to be lateral in our thinking, and we have to understand that if we really want to know what's going on, then we have to make it our business to listen and not just be swayed by one particular person's opinion or point of view.
How's the book doing out there in the market? Do you have any idea?
Dave, I think the book is going fairly well. It's only been released since late October, and look, the book is doing really well.
This was a terrific book. It's very important that folks pick this up if they want to understand what's happening there in that part of the world, in that country. Really, from somebody, like I said, somebody who was on the ground and in a position that they could actually understand what's going on and meeting with significant people in the country, which again, like I said, we only scratch the surface here of this wonderful book. Are you working on any other projects after this?
Yes, I'm currently working on my sequel. My sequel will be titled An Eye for an Eye.
MJ Green, I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to the listeners. I had a wonderful time reading the book. It's not very often where I get to read, like I said, a nonfiction book that reads like a fiction book. But thank you, MJ, so much for the time, and looking forward to speaking to you again in the future.
David, it's been an absolute pleasure. Anytime.